Are you a nonprofit professional who's feeling overwhelmed and burnt out? Well, welcome to the Lead with Heart podcast. I am your host, Haley Cooper. On this podcast, we will share stories of leadership, courage, and empathy that'll help you learn to take care of yourself, your staff, organization, and community. You will hear from nonprofit leaders who have been in your shoes and have learned best practices to raise more revenue and make a greater impact. Let's thrive together.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Lead with Heart podcast. I have Joshua Berry today on the podcast, and we are going to be talking about his book, Dare to Be Naive, How to Find Your True Self in a Noisy World. And Joshua, before we get started, I just want to say welcome to the podcast.
Haley, thank you so much for having me today.
So I would love to know a little bit more about your background. Obviously, we just met offline, and I would love to know a little bit more about your background and what led you to become an author and a thought leader in terms of leadership.
Yep. So my background, I went to school for international business and Spanish. Spent my first 10 years traveling around the globe to almost 30 different countries, doing work around leadership and culture, specifically helping larger organizations identify the people that they want to hire and develop. That was with companies like the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company and Mercedes-Benz and H&R Block and Cheesecake Factory restaurants, which I would go out near where you're at and definitely gained about 15 pounds during those years that I worked with Cheesecake. But those 10 years, I did a number of things around training and facilitation and leadership at that company. Eventually went out on my own into my first startup. We put our house up for sale, pregnant with our fourth kid, and that startup did not work. But that took me on a journey of spending some more time understanding and working with startups, over 100 of them with venture-backed accelerator programs, and eventually then co-founding my own company in 2015. And the journey of Econic and what we do today is really around helping evolve work so that we can unleash more human potential to help solve some of the world's greatest problems. And it's in that body of work, which is now in its, I guess it's, wow, ninth year, that the book came out, and it was just published in November. So I'm excited to be able to bring that to the world. And there's a whole story about the journey of not wanting to write and then eventually writing a book too.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. And I definitely know those name brands and love a good cheesecake from Cheesecake Factory. And a lot of times on this podcast, most of the time, all the time, we talk a lot about culture development and leadership development and how nonprofits can bring that to the table. Because I've seen a lot of times that nonprofits have these solid missions, they have these solid values that they only live out externally, and they forget to take care of the people internally. And so I'm sure it's a little bit different on the corporate side, but I think a lot of the principles can be the same. So what are some of those principles that you use to find people and make sure that they were retained and satisfied within their job?
Yeah, I think you said it well, Haley, in that being able to clearly articulate your values and making them unique enough to the organization, but then also applicable to the organization. So our company, Econic, just has a few core values. I'll give you an example. One of them is whole person, and another one is give more. And both of these two values, whenever we're thinking about changing or shifting one of our policies or our practices, we always take it back and we take it through those values and say, okay, what does 2 years ago we changed how we do our bonus program? And we said, what does give more look like in a new bonus program? What does whole person look like in a new bonus program? And so again, whether you're a large company or you're a not-for-profit, anytime that you can say, here's our stated values, and then be able to bring those back and say, how would we change our policies or procedures to match these even better? Or as you said, the next person we're going to hire, how might we ask them a question or get them to demonstrate in the hiring interview that they possess this, right? One of our values, give more. You could potentially ask the question, tell me about a time when you had to show an abundant mentality or you were giving more in a situation. And seek out to see if that person hopefully has had some of those behaviors or things in the past so that you can hopefully bring more of those, or at least continue to bring those into the organization and continue to inculcate that culture that you're wanting.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I love that you said filtering everything through your core values. And I want to take a step back and ask you, because I think, again, a lot of nonprofits struggle to get really solid values, or they put them in place and they're just there check a box. And so how can you really go through the process with your organization and get buy-in and belonging for these values? What's the first step to instilling these values within an organization?
Yeah, it's actually probably a combination of what you just said, which is it can't be established and then try to create buy-in. You actually have to work with the people in the organization to see what arises. You definitely have likely those unstated values that are there, that if you spend enough time talking to the people, asking for stories about when we were at our best, any of those moments, you can start to see certain themes that arise. Now, some of those might be core values. Other ones might be more aspirational things. And that's okay too, right? You can have some of those things that you say, this is who we are. And aspirationally, we want to do more of this. About 4 or 5 years ago, we added the core value, communicate empathetically. That it wasn't already embedded in this other core value we had. We just pulled it out and we said, you know what? We feel like we're having a gap in terms of acknowledging where people are at and how they're receiving the messages. And so how do we name it as an aspirational value so that we're using it in our process rewrites or we're in our weekly meetings when we're calling out kudos to each other? That's one more that's on the board to say, hey, did we practice communicate empathetically this last week? But I think it comes to your first question. It comes from first talking to staff and working with staff and helping see those themes emerge there and then starting to tool it versus a top-down day strategy session where you come up with the 5 words and then roll those out to people and convince them that those are the values.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And we were just talking about how you can really instill that as an organization. But in your book, Dare to Be Naive, you talk about how you can find oneself as a leader. And I think, again, a lot on this podcast and the work that I do, I talk about leading well from within. It starts with you, then your organization, and then the world. And so it is really important for your organization to have solid values so that everyone has buy-in and belonging and learns to live by those values, both internally and externally. But can you share what you believe are some foundational principles for a leader to truly discover and understand themselves in the professional realm?
Yeah. One foundational value is I don't know everything. Right? That it sounds so simple. And yet the more you can embrace that and to be able to understand, I don't know everything. And catch yourself in those moments when you are being defensive or closed-minded or committed to being right versus being more open or curious. Being able to say, I might be wrong, which is counterintuitive to, I think, what we were taught 30, 40, 50 years ago about leadership is the strong, always a strong vision and commanding and all of those things. And I think similar to other guests you've had on your podcast, Haleen, what you, I think, innately get is that it does come from the heart and what we have inside of us isn't always clear, and that's okay. So the I don't know, or this might be true, or maybe even things have changed is a fundamental principle. I think another is, just continue on that same path, is a good balance between head and heart in terms of what they're bringing to the table. We, especially in corporate America, I think we reward so much this hyper-rational approach to things, right? If it isn't extremely logical and anything that feels intuitive or emotional or spiritual or anything like that kind of gets poo-pooed or put to the side. And yet one of the missions, as you called out in my book, is trying to help people understand that your true self likely embodies all those things. And so rather than trying to mask that and hide it or only bring it out in certain times, I think a good leader is able to create safe spaces for people to bring that in at all times. And it may not be natural to do it. So a good leader also knows how to structure work, whether it's a meeting agenda or the way work is done or other things to make it a space where more of those parts of someone's true self can emerge.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I'm taking notes because I was just talking to Jake Wood, who founded Team Rubicon yesterday. And he said when he first entered his organization, that was his foundational principle was, I don't know everything. I need to hire people and bring people in that will fill in where I lack. And I think that's such an important, humility is such an important part of leadership. And I would love to know when you're talking about balancing the head and the heart and integrating that into strategy meetings or just meetings. And I like to get into the nitty gritty because people like the questions. So how can you find that balance of not just, I think most meetings are like, this is the agenda, this is the outcome. How do you balance that then with like more of the heart side?
Sure. A couple ideas, and I'm definitely not the expert in this, but a couple of ideas that we've done and that we do with our clients is, yes, have an agenda and have outcomes for a meeting, for instance, but also start with something that might be more grounding. Maybe it's acknowledgement that people have been running from 3 or 4 different Zoom calls or meetings and they're coming together. How do you start with a minute or two just to find yourself? We'll start with a moment of silence or meditation sometimes or others in a meeting, even with corporate executives, just to be able to ground them. If that feels a little out there, well, then even just a warm-up question to be able to bring it in. The question that we used in a meeting this morning actually was, did you have a moment of alone time during the holidays? And if so, what did you do with it? And so just being able to bring people into a shared sense of space, I think allows at least the opportunity for there to be more openness. Another example that I'll give is being aware of dynamics, for instance, in a meeting where maybe someone who is more extroverted or dominant or because of authority, maybe, you know, taking control of things, and instead figure out, are there ways to be able to pull in everybody, especially because if it's an organization where head dominated thinking looms large, well, maybe the people who are quieter are the ones who have a different type of perspective. So a simple tool that we use for that is brain dumping. So maybe we throw out a question there, but then rather than, you know, people start popcorning up answers, the first step is everybody take some post-it notes and write down your thoughts to it. It does a couple of simple things. One, it makes it very visual to everybody else that everybody has a thought or an idea. And so you can call people out. Third one, you're going to have to stop me now. Now you've got me flowing.
I love it. One
is, it's been around for decades, but Edward de Bonos came up with this idea called the 6 thinking hats. Are you familiar with this at all, Haley?
No.
It's a way to say that in most conversations, what ends up happening is a lot of thinking is happening at once. You've got someone who's being optimistic. You've got someone who's being cynical. You've got someone who's wanting to talk about facts and someone who wants to talk about feeling. And what de Bono's 6 thinking hats did is said, we can actually create what's called parallel thinking. Let's name that there is a hat that we're all going to put on at the same time. And the prompt is, what could go right with this situation or problem? Great. Everybody take it off. Now everybody put on the next hat. What could go wrong in this situation? There's one that's only the facts. There's one that's only the feelings. And what it does is it gives leaders a structure or a system to be able to invite in all those aspects of a whole person to come to the table there. And the fun thing, when we facilitated meetings using that technique, the fun thing is you see different people light up or talk more depending upon which hat is in play. It just shows you that those different natural impulses were already there. You're just creating structure for more of that to come in, and it gives you a more well-rounded head, heart, gut feel.
Yeah, I love that. I have to look that up because I think it's so important for what you said is not everyone's going to popcorn their ideas, but if you give space for people to be able to speak up, to share their ideas, they have that buy-in and belonging. They feel seen and heard. And that is like the basic need that we have, is to feel seen and heard, to feel like we belong. And so providing that space makes people more collaborative, more willing to communicate, and essentially more productive.
I think you're right. And it does, back to the point of leadership and leadership development here, it does start with good modeling from the leader. I was on another call today where someone called out and said an idea that was a little bit unpopular to the team. And the senior leader, the president in that group, jumped in right away and acknowledged and said, I see you throwing out something that could have been hard to say. Thank you for taking that risk. That modeling of this is the type of behavior, either in calling it out or doing it themselves, both of those things add so much to getting more of that heart-centered leadership in play.
Yeah, I think that's so important. So back to really embodying as a leader, because again, it starts with you. And there's some nuances to that, especially when you're working in an organization. But how can leaders really integrate this idea of self-discovery into their ongoing growth journey? And are there any specific practices or habits that you recommend to help leaders learn more about themselves and how to show up as a leader? Hey there, podcast family. If you're like me and deeply committed to improving your leadership skills and fostering better connections with your team, I've got something truly amazing to share with you. I'm proud to introduce the EMC Masterclass, something I talk about often as a certified trainer. It's an incredible program developed by the renowned Dr. Lola Gershfeld, an organizational psychologist and corporate emotional connection expert. You might remember her from a podcast episode where she shared invaluable insights into the world of emotional connection. Dr. Gershfeld's EMC Leaders courses are designed for anyone working with people, whether you're a manager, supervisor, team leader, educator, coach, mentor, or a team member. This program is truly for everyone looking to enhance their communication and collaboration skills to raise more revenue for their mission. Now, let me tell you why the EMC Masterclass is a game changer. Dr. Gershfeld's groundbreaking emotional connection process has been integrated into top universities' curriculum and recognized by international organizations like ICF, HRCI, and SHRM. Humans are wired to seek emotional safety, and when we feel safe, we're more likely to take risks, share innovative ideas, and collaborate effectively. The EMC process is the catalyst for creating that emotional safety within your team. The virtual EMC Masterclass consists of 8 modules with 4 hours of expertly recorded material, 13 quizzes to reinforce your learning, and a workbook filled with activities for offline practice and something I still refer to daily. Ready to become an emotional connection master? Dr. Gershfeld is offering an exclusive deal for our podcast listeners. Use the code LEADWITHHEART to enjoy a generous 10% discount on the EMC Masterclass. Head over to emcleaders.com and enroll in the EMC Masterclass today.
One of the things that's inspired me over the last couple of years has been the work by Byron Katie, which is in Ohio, so out near you. And when I first started writing my book and then came across some of her work, I started to see that what I was trying to bring to the world and creating space for people to explore their limiting beliefs and what they're needed, that she had some great, an amazing body of work to be able to build upon. And so I came up with my own version of 4 questions that you can use to help you further lean into what your leadership style is and what you're doing. And it basically comes back to, let's say you want to do something and you have a new practice or a new idea, or you have something you want to do and you're saying, I can't do that because, like I can't start this new fundraising campaign because I don't have the time. It'll take it away from my family. The 4 questions help us to create more self-awareness as leaders, in that you would take that potentially limiting belief of, I don't have the time because it'll take it away from my family. And you start to ask yourself, where did I learn that belief? Where did I learn that I don't have enough time and taking that time away would be from my family? But it may be legit, but at least creating pause allows you to think on it. The 2nd question, is it true? Is it actually true? Maybe or maybe not. It could be a rhetorical question, but I know a lot of times I make up excuses about what I have time for or not, and I can always find time for the stuff that at least part of me wants to do. But you can challenge yourself on that. The 2nd 2 questions then become the most powerful. What do I gain by holding this belief that I don't have enough time? I'll take it away from my family. It's a really hard question. But to be able to sit with that, and actually even to name and express something, and even to logic, this is where it goes back to head and heart, because what you're doing is you're engaging this feeling you have with trying to add logic to it. What do I gain from saying I'm too busy or my family needs me? You do gain something, and because there is something that's being gained there, it likely keeps you in that space from doing that thing. So the first step in it is acknowledging it. And then at least in this example, what do I lose is the 4th question. What do I lose by holding this belief? That one might be a little bit easier, because in this one, I'm losing maybe doing this new campaign or doing this other thing, or I might be even losing, now that I'm thinking about it, I might be losing the opportunity to show my kids that this thing really matters to me and what it looks like to do things that are discerning and to be able to say, here's something that I need to do because of this reason. It might be the lesson, the exact lesson my kids need at that time, right? But until you go through that exercise, even me right now, until I start to think through those questions, I don't start to pick apart those beliefs or those ideas that might be subconsciously driving some of the things that I'm interested or not interested in doing or preventing me from really doing more fulfilling work.
Yeah, I think that's so important, because something in the last year that I've learned that has really been foundational in my own leadership journey is that your beliefs influence your thoughts, which influence your emotions and influence your actions. So a lot of in the work that I talk about is rejection mindset, because I've met board members who say, I don't want to fundraise because I'm not good at it. And they think about the ask and they're scared about rejection, because somewhere along the way, I was rejected from a lot of birthday parties in my day. So I had this belief of rejection and I was really scared about it. So I became a people pleaser. And so I had to rewire my belief about rejection because it was holding me back from asking for more money.
Yeah.
So I know it's a whole process, but I think just by acknowledging that from the neuroscience standpoint, relaxes your amygdala so that you are able to think clearly and decide, okay, I understand, I'm aware of this belief, but what's the next step? Like, how do people start to then take proactive action? Because most of the time, these beliefs have been instilled in us from very young. So it takes a while to rewire them. But how can we take proactive action to begin to show up in ways that we didn't before because of those beliefs?
I think that's a great example. And thank you for sharing that. I would have invited you to a birthday party, Haley. So I'm sorry.
Thank you.
The next step is, this is really learned from all of our work with venture-backed startups and corporate innovation teams, because they're constantly faced with trying things that aren't going to work. The best practices we learned there is, if you have something you're curious about, in this case, maybe a new way of being, maybe a new way of asking something, how do you do the next smallest, easiest, ethically responsible thing, right? Like, how do you start to test and experiment against those things? Because if you can start to get yourself in a flywheel of being curious, and then the next tiny action you can take to be able to test that curiosity, one of two things will typically happen. If you do that action and it works, you'll continue the flywheel and you'll say, oh, okay, that wasn't as bad. It wasn't as scary. If it doesn't work, more often than not, you realize, because it was so small, that, you know what, that didn't hurt as bad as I imagined it would have. First time you go out and do a little tiny ask on something new and you get rejected, if you're self-aware enough, maybe you're working with a coach or anything, you can look at yourself and be like, I'm still here. Look, I'm okay. Maybe I'll try again, or I'll do another thing. And so we always say, break it down to the next smallest action that gets you to act and be able to try that out. And those are the things that I think get a lot of people out into the streets and doing work. And again, we saw this so much with startups and other corporate innovation teams. They would just want to stay in the garage and they'd want to stay in the building, keep making it look perfect and polish the website and work on the name of the thing and all of this stuff that's not very risky, versus getting into that uncomfortable space, but doing it in a small way that allows you to be able to get some learning and try and start to get that flywheel going.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I was thinking about that recently, because one of the things that I struggle with is speaking. And I think I work out every day, I build muscle, and it's almost like you have to build that muscle. Like, it's just, you take that one step and you're like, oh, I can do this. And then you like progress to asking for more or speaking up in more uncomfortable situations. And I think it's, again, like you said, that flywheel, but also building that muscle and yeah, making sure that you practice it.
I think you're exactly right. I think the other way is, and you even said it before, like, I'm a thought leader. I bristle at that sometimes, because one of my missions in life is to help other people lead their own thoughts. Like, I'm a very reluctant thought leader in that case. And what that means to me is, you, Haley, and you're asking, whoever's listening to this and they're asking or doing or whatever it is, you have your own unique style and you have it inside of you. It's great to look at best practices. It's great to learn from other people. But some of the most powerful stuff is being able to sit and quiet and look inside. What is your heart telling you? What feels intuitively correct? And then trying that next. And it may not look like everybody else's thing. For a lot of my life, I've done business development and sales, but held up to a number of other salespeople, I am a terrible salesperson. I hate asking or telling people that they should buy stuff that I don't think that they need. And therefore, I am so reluctant at quote unquote asking for a sale. I think I'd be a bad fundraiser. Maybe you could make me better at it, Haley, but I think I would be bad at it. And yet, it works for me because I have my style of relationship and generosity and other things that we've been able to continue to grow our company and other things through my style of what that is. But it's because I had to understand what is it that I want to lead and how do I want to lead and to own some of that for myself.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And obviously the relationship aspect of fundraising is like the most critical part. So you're already there. You don't need to, it's all about relationships. And like you mentioned, so one of my favorite books from 2023 was Shakti Leadership by Nilima Bhatt. And she says, leadership requires knowing how to journey within, knowing how to come into your own. You can't lead anyone or anything if you don't know what's leading you. So it comes back to that principle of what you just said of really knowing those beliefs or what's driving your action and being able to lead so that you can lead others.
Yeah, that's a beautiful quote. I hadn't heard that. Thank you so much for sharing that. It reminds me again back to some of the research that I pulled from the book. And that's, the title is Dare to Be Naive. And a lot of people think being naive in business and nonprofits, et cetera, is a bad thing. But what I was able to find is that the fear of being seen as naive actually prevents people from having greater impact and greater joy in their lives. And because of that, it led me into thinking like, well, what does it actually mean to be naive? And why do people fear this thing? What I learned, Haley, is that the word naive actually used to just mean natural or innate or genuine or authentic. It was that thing that you were born with at the very beginning, very similar to that quote from Shakti Leadership. And so when I'm daring people to be naive, it's similar to that. What I'm saying is, if you feel something inside of you and you're like, I can't speak this or I shouldn't do it, or it'll sound naive or it'll sound silly or it'll sound unlogical or unsophisticated or whatnot, it might actually be coming from a deeper sense of wisdom that you have had since the start. So I just encourage people that in their exploration, to your point of being, of what your true self is and what it might be, a lot of times we're actually having to come back to a deeper wisdom we probably already had at the beginning. We're just having to like cut through some of that noise to be able to rediscover what that was.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I love how you frame that. I think another important aspect of your book and something that a generation or that we've lost in terms of social media and now AI is the aspect of critical thinking. And I think this is an important thing, critical thinking, discernment, and being able to be your own leader in this day and age with so much noise in the world. So what are some of the frameworks that you use to promote that growth mindset and facilitate that intentional leadership?
To your point, more critical thinking and more strategic thinking is absolutely what is needed. I did a keynote down in Austin a few months ago, and afterwards somebody said, I love your book. I love your talk. I really like this other book too, though. His book told me exactly what I needed to do. Your book is making me think. And that's okay too. Okay. Thank you. But in our work with organizations, what we keep hearing is they want more and more people who can think strategically or think critically. And so helping those people have frameworks, as you said, whether it's the four questions that I shared before, or another one that we use is when you have a practice that you're trying to discuss. An example, we were working with an organization who was figuring out how to work with their labor negotiations or their union. And you know, the one side was talking about, oh, we're giving too much. And the other side is talking about, oh, we're not giving enough. What we were able to do is we were able to help them see, well, the practices you're talking about actually are powered by the principles or beliefs. It's similar to what you said before. And so a framework to be able to say, what is the practice and what are the beliefs that you're aware of or unaware of that are powering that? And then do you actually believe those things? So being able to work through those things is extremely important. Another one is systems thinking and or analysis that we'll end up doing, which is, okay, you have a problem. Asking a leader, instead of trying to get to the root cause of it, to first take a step back and say, what are all the component parts of this problem? There's people that's in this. There's time. There's resources. There's this vendor that's a part of it. Just being able to help people do quick little exercises of zooming out and saying, what's all a part of this ecosystem that is a part of this problem or the stakeholders that are part of it? Help people to get to a little bit more critical thinking. A third one that I'll throw at you is the quick exercise of doing a pre-mortem or a pre-parade, depends on what your culture likes, but being able to ask a team to say, okay, we're getting started with something here. We've done all of our planning. Now let's fast forward. let's do a pre-parade and say 6 months from now, the campaign, the project, whatever it is, was a screaming success. We are toasting Asti in your favorite place on the beach. What are we toasting? What are we specifically saying worked well? Write all those things down. Or if you prefer, you can do the reverse of that, which is a pre-mortem. We're all now toasting PBR and drowning in our sorrows and saying, what is it that we're complaining about that we missed that didn't work? And any tools or exercises like that just force people to start to think about things from different angles and hopefully get them to think more critically or more broadly, which is so, so desperately needed.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And I like to talk about the power of generative questions. So a podcast episode was shared about Delta was having a baggage claim problem, and they were asking how they can make better baggage claim, but it turned into how can we make a better customer experience? And so I think a lot of nonprofits now that we're recording this in January, they're coming off of their fundraising campaigns. And if you didn't raise as much revenue as you wanted to, like thinking about not only the failures, but thinking as failure as a learning opportunity. And yes, you can drown yourself in PBR too on the beach. If you're on the beach, you're not really drowning yourself, but how can you ask questions about like positive questions that lead to a more positive future that will create a greater outcome? How can you create a better donor experience this year? How did you collaborate well? What strengths were pulled out so that you can continue to see the strengths and build on those? And see whatever failures were as growth opportunities. And I think you talk a lot about growth opportunity because in your book, in terms of a lot of people fear failure and so they don't take risks, but there is learning opportunities in that. So what are your thoughts on that?
Michael Caine has the famous quote, use your difficulty, right? If there was one piece of advice that you would share with people, it's use the difficulty. So in everything, there is something to be learned, especially if you're viewing this life as a gift that's for you, right? And so if you are approaching things in that way, there's always something that you can take away or learn from it. And I really like those generative questions that you're asking. What is the thing we could do next? Or we'll like to use the acronym HMW. How might we? It makes you jump. You don't have to know the how quite yet. Just start with how might we learn from this? How might we get our goals down on paper earlier? How might we? And just getting your lists of your how might we's is a great way towards thinking more generatively and thinking more about how to take this and take it forward.
Ooh, I like that. I always love having these conversations where we can have the same idea, but two different perspectives. And it's great. My next question for you is how can leaders really strike that balance between self-reflection and taking that step back and maybe asking the how might we show up questions and taking concrete steps towards action?
You do need to have a good strategy and vision and the aspirations that you're trying to drive towards so that there is action, right? That it, the things are aligned with. I don't know, maybe your experience or work has been different, but I oftentimes they'll find that people already have enough to do and enough activity. Their problem isn't figuring out how to act. It's how to act more intentionally. And so it's being able to get people to say, maybe here is either the strategy and we're going to look at the activities that we do and hold that up against the strategy. Or another term people will use sometimes is your principles or design principles. So we don't confuse it with principles from before. We're going to do these things. Let's come up with how we want to approach it and then make sure that our activities are in alignment with those things. Those are ways that you don't always have to slip back into reflection mode. Is this something that's in alignment with who I am or what my values are? If you can codify those things, values like we talked about before, design principles, strategic elements, objectives, any of those things can be things that help you say, okay, am I in alignment with where we're trying to go? And can we act on those things? I think the other piece that maybe can push people further to action is also taken from our startup and our innovation work is the thinking about things more in sprints than needing to have the full plan waterfalled all the way out. And so if you know the objective or where you're trying to go, how might you just break it down into the next 2 weeks of things you need to do? And oftentimes people are like, well, but then I need to know the next 2 weeks and the next 2 weeks and the next 2 weeks. And But we've all been there, that when we lay that stuff out, it never goes as according to plan. In fact, if you're working on complex issues and problems, like to think that you can predict your way and control it all the way there is actually what leads to so much frustration and fatigue for people. But instead, if you broke down maybe your working cadence to this is where we're going long term or for the year, for the quarter, the next 2 weeks of work is this. Great. Now, once we get to the end of those 2 weeks, let's do a retrospective on what worked, what didn't work. How can we improve how we work overall as a team in terms of processes or structures? What's the work for the next 2 weeks? Great. Do it that way. You can start to create different structures so that you can still do activity, but just do it more intentionally. And then hopefully build in some more of those reflection points.
Oh, you're speaking straight to me, because if I don't know all the plans and all the steps to get to that plan, it leads to inaction because I'm like, I need to know every step of the way. And I've learned that I can break it down in bite size and just take that initial step or take that action. And it actually leads to more of a positive outcome and what I actually want. So I don't necessarily need to know. I'm just laying myself out here. All the answers. I think as we're talking, and you talk in your book, authentic leadership is often mentioned in discussions about finding oneself as a leader. And often in nonprofits, we tend to get mission drift. And an opportunity comes along that doesn't necessarily fit with our mission. And we take that opportunity out of a scarcity mindset, because if we don't get it, then another one's not going to come. And so as leaders, along those lines of scarcity mindset and really living authentically, are there any specific practices or exercises that can help leaders stay true to themselves while effectively leading others?
Yeah. Ooh, that is so hard. Because again, as an entrepreneur with the name on the line of credit, with all of those sorts of things, you're right. Like sometimes that scarcity mindset creeps in. You're like, oh, we could just say yes to this thing. Admittedly, I have. To those things in the past, and it does create things. So being able to have other things that help keep you either accountable or at least to call out the drift, I think is important. I think, though, not feeling guilt or shame for that, but just being able to be more aware of it. For our team, we will talk about, we think we're going to take this project on because of these reasons. It isn't fully aligned with that. How do we feel all about that? And bringing the team into it helps out immensely. The other thing that was triggered for me as you were talking about that is, I don't know if your experience has been this, but I have noticed that when I start to cling really hard to a goal or a thing or whatnot, and that scarcity mindset comes in, like it almost creates that reality. And other times when I hold things way looser and come at things with an abundance mentality, that also creates itself more often than not. And sometimes that means, oh, and then a deal comes. But sometimes it means the deal doesn't come, but because of the nature and the state that I'm in, I'm actually more open to the lesson that I was supposed to learn at that time. So there's still abundance. It's just in a different way that comes from that. And to tie back to the heart-based piece of this, like it's interesting how that just continues to work. And we create our own vicious cycles, or we create our own virtuous cycles through that type of approach. And so I think that being able to find ways to remind yourself, to give yourself the grace for those things is important. I will say a happy medium between those two that we've done is we've realized that if we want to live in a more abundance way, and I'll give you a concrete example. If a project isn't coming in with a client, or in your case, or some of your listeners, maybe if this big gift is not coming in, we've already thought about what are the other systems in our organization that need to be more flexible and resilient so that we're not dependent upon it. So for instance, in our world, we use full-time employees, we have part-time employees, we have consistent contractors, and we have gig contractors. We use that to give resiliency in our system. We keep way more cash on hand than we likely need to. The reason we do that is because we don't want to be dependent upon needing this next person to say yes. We want it to be at their time. And what that's done for us, because we built resiliency in systems, it allows us to then be more abundant in those conversations with people. And there have been several times where clients have said, "Ooh, we're thinking about this project," and we're the ones who will say, "I don't know if it's the right time for you yet to do that. Maybe in 3 months or 6 months or whatever it might be." And what's interesting is because we've held that so loosely, it just continues to build trust and relationship with people there, because we're not doing it because it's gimmicky. We're not doing it because we're going to get the sale later. We're doing it because genuinely we're trying to do what's in the best interest of them. And we've built our other systems to hopefully create our ability to act out of that way.
Yeah. And I think there's definitely science to that, to what you're saying, because, and it goes back to that belief mindset, right? Like, our belief influences our reality. Your beliefs influence your actions towards that reality. So if you're acting out of a scarcity mindset, you're going to accept that client, even though it's not right time for them. And then it's doing both of you a disservice. Like you said, if you have that abundant mindset, your action is to be okay with saying no, and out of true, genuine care for that organization, and not out of the own selfish gain. And then that ends up back to your book, and what it's all about is creating that ripple effect for good.
Yeah. You have to realize and believe in this. And again, I think there's a lot of heart work that you're probably playing a longer and a deeper and a different game at this level of things. And so there's one of the stories that I share in the book about a manager who, one of the people he was leading got to the end of his, like the growth they could probably have in the organization, and was looking for some more growth. He was talking to me and he said, "Do you have a mentor or anybody who might be able to help this gentleman?" And I said, "I do, but he actually works at your competitor across the state." And the manager thought about it for a little bit and he said, "You know what? I think that's all right. That's the thing that he needs." So imagine that, like a manager telling one of their direct reports, "Hey, I think you should go have coffee with a competitor down the street because it might be good for your growth." And several months later, I came back and interviewed, his name's Michael, for the book. And I said, "What were you thinking there?" Because that would be called naive. Why would anybody do that? And he very much said, "I'm playing a different game here, right? At the end of the day, I want him to flourish. And you know what? If he leaves, yeah, we'll be in a bind, but everybody else would have seen that we were doing the right thing. And that would be a net positive. Also, if he didn't leave, maybe he learned something really great. He knows how much I care and I trust for him. Like, I don't see how I'm losing in this." But he had to reframe what game, quote unquote, that he was playing there, to be able to shift into that more heart-centered and generous sort of leadership.
Yeah, I think people have to dare to do things a little bit differently now.
That's why it's the dare to be naive. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything, as you wrap up, anything more that you want people to know about your book?
It'll be a little bit different book than what people are used to. We've been getting amazing reviews so far that it is a quick, but not a simple read. And so people are enjoying it because of that. It's very story driven. And it's really about creating space for people to start to think through what they actually believe, especially in a number of different business settings. Went out of my way to create a lot of diversity in the people that were interviewed and highlighted in it. So I'm very proud of who we're getting to represent and share stories of people who may not be the normal faces of success and leadership out in the world. And just that what my intent and goal is to understand that the world needs more of each and every one of us in it. And whether it's through this book, whether it's through your podcast, whether it's through whatever is touching you right now, do your work and figure out ways that you can continue to bring more of you into the world, because we need that.
Oh, such a good place to end. Where can people find your book and find you?
Yep. The book website is daretobenaive.com. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the major online retailers. It's also in airports these couple of months, so that will be fun. And you can find me, I'm most active on LinkedIn. And so if you go to LinkedIn and you look for Joshua Berry, connected to either the book Dare to Be Naive or Econic. And I can for sure share the links for the show notes.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you so much, Joshua. I've learned so much from you, and I'm just so honored to have had this conversation with you.
Haley, keep doing amazing, great, heartfelt work.
If you have valued these stories or learned something from what you've heard, please share this podcast episode or follow me on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for your support, and together we can build a better community and world.